This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Benjamin Franklin once said, "Tell me and I forget, teach me and I may remember, involve me and I learn." Simply put, that's the philosophy behind inquiry or project-based learning, and it's an educational method whose effectiveness has been borne out by research. So today we're exploring local initiatives to make science education more interactive and engaging. Later this hour, we'll talk with the director of a new STEM academy getting started in Sandwich. STEM stands, of course, for science, technology, engineering, and math, at least in most cases. As of next September, all 7th and 8th graders in Sandwich will be immersed in high-tech, inquiry-driven learning. But teachers in Sandwich aren't waiting until next year to embrace interactive science education. Climate Lab is a hands-on climate science education project developed by scientists at Manomet Center for Conservation Sciences in collaboration with Wildland Trusts and TURC, a Cambridge-based curriculum development organization focused on improving math and science education. The project was first piloted at Plymouth's Rising Tide Charter School. This year, it's expanding into schools in Duxbury and Sandwich. On a rainy morning last week, project coordinator Beth Brazil and Trevor Lloyd Evans, a migratory bird expert from Manomet Center for Conservation Sciences, visited Forestdale School in Sandwich. Teachers Peter Trimble and Renee Fadala had recently attended a climate lab workshop, and it was time to pick a site for students to start monitoring. They took us to the edge of school property, and Trevor Lloyd Evans headed into the woods to explore what the site has to offer.
All set. We'll come back and set it up later.
This is an obvious old trail.
So this will be perfect. Let's quickly look around at what we have. Evan has volunteered to take notes. Thank you, Evan. So everyone know white oak? White oak with the paler trunk and the nice lobed leaves here. We have a number of, and I'm going to call them black/red oaks. And we don't really care which at this time of year, but that nice reddish tinge to the pointy leaves there is red oak. We have pitch pine in here. And again, this is a perfectly fine thing that we can be starting to work with students. You can go out and collect leaves right now and have them getting familiar with these. So all we really need to do is we would like a sample of minimum 30. And if we can do more than that, fine. And we want the students to be able to go in on those transects. We'll put tree tags on the trees, mm-hmm. if that's okay with you guys. They'll
Absolutely.
Be numbered.
Yes.
So we'll have banded trees, just like our banded birds.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can get heights and DBHs. At our teacher training down there in Bourne, we talked about just giving a good estimate and having a 2-meter pole and everyone's standing there, right, and sort of lifting that up to 2 meters and estimating the height of the tree. What? How good are students at that level at doing things like estimating with a lot of heavy hand-holding by Renee and Peter?
I think they'll be just fine.
You're good at that?
I do, yes.
The other option is you do that because that's quick. We've got our diameter tapes, so we'll get our DBHs, which is always fun, so then we'll have some baseline information on these trees. The other option is we can go back to the old tangents and we can pull our tape back 20 meters and we can put a broomstick up and measure the angle to the top of the tree and the tangent is the, vertical over the distance. So are they up for that as well?
I think so, and I know that the math teachers would be very much interested in us doing that as well, for sure.
So lead us on and let's see where the trail goes a little way. Is that a good thing
to do?
Sure, yeah. All right. So we're going to the same or different sort of forest. When we come in from the edge, we'll try to come in straight. And if it's horrible stuff like multiflora rose here, which we've got a vast amount of, then we can come in a shorter distance. We don't necessarily have to come in every 50 meters.
Or
as long as we come back.
Or we can move it
10 one way or 10 the other way. As long as we come back to the same location year after year. So all we need is consistency on that. So that's part one of it. Part one of it is we've got some trees marked, and we've got some heights and DBHs. Part two is along those transects, we'd like to be able on set timing days, let's say we're in middle of May, during the growth period of all of these deciduous leaves, then what we would really like to do then is get the students out and measuring individual trees and probably shrubs and herbs. So we have got sweet fern down here. We have perfectly nice sheep laurel over there, which is one of the species that we have used. And that's an easy thing to tag some plants in there. And so we can put individual tags on those plants. So we can take almost anything deciduous. You've got northern arrowwood in there, Viburnum recognitum. That would be a perfectly nice thing. That's leafing out in the middle of May. And then we need to come back in the sort of midsummer period, sometime in June, sometime before school comes out, and we need to get the fully formed, and that'll give us the percentage stage that each of these species was leafed out during the growth period in May. And if we can keep coming back to the same individuals time after time, that's great. You know, our protocol has been to mark some tags on the branches and say, let's randomly choose five leaves. And that gives us all the fun things that you can get into with students as, what is random? And which five do I choose? And do I choose the biggest five or the smallest five? And do I want the little one? And, sir, this one is curled up, which is what some of our students said to us with the Canada Mayflowers when we were doing this test. So do we measure the width of the curled up leaf and the length of the curled up leaf, or do we flatten it out? So we thought about that for a while and said, well, what's the leaf doing? The leaf is probably trying to get chlorophyll to the sunlight. And if it's curled up, it's only showing this much. So let's measure the curled, but let's note it down. And so that's why our graphs ended up with curled versus flattened leaves. But basically, we were able to compare that with the year before. And the year before, everything leafed out a lot earlier. This year, it was a rather late leaf out. What have we got here? We're staring at this, aren't we? Rather dubiously in our mind.
Looks like an invasive of some sort.
Looks like red osier dogwood. But would red osier dogwood be here? Yes, it would, I think. I think it is. I think it's red osier. Yeah. Yeah. You've got quite a lot of, along the edge, I noticed that you've got either Russian olive or autumn olive. Seems like it's sneaking in. Wareham was absolutely overrun with bittersweet, so we're trying to pick trees that aren't absolutely covered with bittersweet down there, but there's quite a lot of it there, so we actually sort of gave them a vine category since they had so many vines coming in anyway. So I think you've got everything you need in this one area here. Perfect. What happens if you go down there? Let's find out. So Eliagnus. And we've got a lot of, and that's an introduction, we've got a lot of multiflora rose, which is obviously introduced. We've got nice young pitch pines coming on. The good thing about the trees is if we have a mixture of small and large trees in there, that's good. It's also much more fun to be able to measure the height of a little tree that's within the range of our... Oh, it's 2.6 metres, that's great. So that'll work out well. This looks great. You've got all sorts of good stuff here.
It's...
Blue Jay! He's getting towards an imitation of a red-tailed hawk. He's thinking about it, isn't he? Yes.
And there are a couple of red tails that spend a lot of time here. So
he learns from them.
I'm sure.
Okay. We're going to wander out.
Trevor, can you just explain the basics, what some of the measurements are that the students are actually going to be taking to try to get a handle on climate change?
Okay, so we can provide data on spring migration of birds and show that birds are arriving back earlier, but students can't go out and measure 40 years of data. You can't buy 40 years of data. Wish we could. It'd be neat if we had 80. We want to know what happened back then. So what we can do is we can look at the habitat that our migrant birds are passing through, and obviously it's just habitat for everything. It's not just birds. We are saying that we'll take three basic sets of measurement on the vegetation. One will be standard height and DBH of trees and teach students how to do
that. So what is DBH?
DBH is diameter breast high. I apologize. Yeah, that's one of those jargon words. And it's very neat because you get a nice tape measure, and the tape measure does something clever like dividing by pi. So you put your tape measure around the tree and it gives you the diameter. Very neat. Very exciting. So we can all go back to our mathematics, which I'm a little shaky on at this point, and work out exactly why that works. So that basically gives you the parameters of the tree. It gives you the width of the tree at a standardized height.
So whose breast do you use to determine diameter?
We will choose an average student.
of what age? I mean, we could be measuring anywhere from a foot off the ground to 5 feet off the ground, right?
We could. This is rather like the meter, which was what, I don't know, wasn't it the stride of King Louis the something of France?
Most of them have some obscure.
There
meaning.
Is something totally obscure like this. There is indeed an actual height measurement for diameter breast high. Secondly, we are really interested interested in the timing of leaf out. And so we're getting at the timing of leaf out two ways, on the local trees and shrubs that we are identifying right here on this property, in this school in Sandwich. And so we're interested in how much growth has there been at some standardized time, like, say, in the middle of May, and ideally go back and do that year after year. And there'll be cold years and there'll be warm years. But the trend should be that if things are going the way they seem to be going, that that leaf out will be happening earlier. And that raises the whole questions about how can wildlife adapt to this. Can a migratory bird from Costa Rica come back and still synchronize with the little green caterpillars on the leaf? So it's hard to measure the caterpillars. It's really hard to measure the birds' differences at a micro scale, but we can certainly measure leaves. So we're looking at growth of indicator species of leaves here, and then going back in the middle of summer when the leaves are fully grown, so that we'll have a percentage. There were 15%, there were 25%, there were 75% leafed out in the middle of May. And then finally, on the transects that we've been talking about, we're introducing again students to transects. We're laying out tapes. We're having them have no end of fun walking backwards into the forest for 50 meters, holding the end of a tape and measuring things, and then walking along there and taking our ocular tube, the famous inside of the toilet roll, and looking up at the canopy, giving an estimate of when you look at the crosshairs in your canopy, are you seeing canopy above you? Are you seeing shrub layer below you? Are you seeing herb layer down below? And getting them again to estimate this over samples of 100 or so, so that we really begin to get that.
Now, for you guys as teachers, I mean, with all the new standards coming into place, obviously adding in a new project and trying to fit that into the standards, you guys have the help here of Manomet and Turk, I guess, trying to help make that fit. But how much extra work is it, and how much of a benefit is it to you to have a project like this going on?
Well, I have found over the years, educationally speaking, that the more you involve the kids in actual real science, actual real math, those sorts of things, they learn it and they understand it better and they carry it forward with them and become more interested in things. So if they're actually out solving problems and looking for answers, it's obviously much better education for those students.
Do you feel any hesitance in teaching climate science? And do you think that a project like this, where you can kind of step back as the messenger and say, see for yourself, does it make it easier to teach something that's perhaps a little controversial in that way?
Well, I personally don't have any issues with teaching about climate science, but the idea that we're actually doing the measurements that may end up showing these students or the community that there is this change happening, the proof is in the pudding, if you will.
And I really think it's a great opportunity for students to be able to come out into the back of the school to use scientific equipment over a period of time and to compare this data over long term compared to Manomet's data, for example, on migratory birds, and make that relationship between when is this plant leafing out? Are these animals ready for the caterpillars that will feed on those leaves? Are they timing it exactly right? And I just think it's intriguing for our students to come out and to be a part of this project. It gets them very engaged, and they'll make the connection, you know.
Well, you know, one of the challenges of climate science and, of course, of teaching climate change is that it's not just math or just physical science or just biological science. It really crosses all of those. So how much of a challenge is it as a teacher where you've, you know, maybe got an hour and you're supposed to be teaching physical science to be trying to incorporate all of these different aspects?
Well, fortunately for us, going to the STEM Academy, the director, Gil Newton, is very much interested in the quality of the education that the students get. And it's not about covering material. It's about actually learning and understanding and going into detail and making a difference. So the idea of quote-unquote covering material is something that I don't stress about.
That's refreshing to hear.
Thank you.
Also, with our Common Core standards in Massachusetts, we're teaching a spiraling curriculum where if you're a 7th or 8th grade teacher, teaching life science, physical science, and earth science all in 1 year. So it really makes the connections for kids.
So what kind of ages are we talking about? And Trevor, maybe you can address this as well. I mean, what kind of age range are we trying to target with this project?
We have worked with high school students. I've worked a lot with undergraduate students, Central America running around doing all sorts of things. But for this particular thing, we're aiming for 6th, 7th and 8th grade. That seems to be the sort of perfect age. And I think sometimes this sort of comes back to that. What was that book by Richard Luoff? Was it Last Child in the Woods? That's the age we really like to get students out. And students are really enthusiastic. They're all excited at that point. If we can get them out in the woods, probably as all of us were, digging in the streams and damming things up and looking at birds and catching caterpillars and doing all that sort of good
stuff. Still young enough to be excited about getting your hands wet and your feet muddy, but also far enough along in school to have some of those basic math skills that you're not going to be doing these same measurements with a first grader. So.
Exactly. And, you know, I haven't seen a whole lot of difference between 7th and 8th grade students that we worked at and also sort of 12th grade students. They're still all excited about it, but they get a little blasé as they get older. So that's our perfect age. That's what we're starting at. But again, there's no reason that we can't take this to scale. And there's no reason that along with Turk, if this all develops the way we hope it will after a few pilot years, we're looking at a 3-year pilot program now, then we might be able to adapt this to high school, or we might be able to adapt it to any age class, really.
So then is the idea that, you know, over a 3-year period, each year the sixth graders, say, that year would be doing these measurements, and then the next year the sixth graders would be doing it. But would the same classes also be following it along? So they would be doing these measurements as a sixth grader and again as a seventh grader and again as an eighth grader and following it personally?
Yes, I think that the more data they take and the more relationship they see in the length and width of different plants and how that changes over time, the more they get really involved in the program and understand that climate change is affecting us and the species around us.
Now, Beth, I know the idea eventually is to make this a national program. What is the status of that expansion? Is that pretty much a hope at this point, or are you concretely working on making this a more national program?
I call it a pipe dream at this point. It's certainly a hope.
It's definitely, it has definite possibilities, but we're definitely trying to make it something really solid before we take it to the next level. What we are doing now is applying for grants, which really makes us think about strategy. So this year we are working with 3 school districts, and that's plenty for us to see how the actual curriculum is, because now we actually have Turk that is providing curriculum matching up with standards. We need the feedback from teachers. Is this something useful to them? Where would they tweak it? And after we get that information, then we'll probably revise it again. And each year we'd like to add different school districts. And within Massachusetts right now, the hope is to add more of an urban school district, for example. And we are talking with some California-based organizations that would be our counterpart, for example. So there's definitely the concept. We're reaching out to start establishing some partnerships, but that's more long-term. I think we're trying to do this very methodically, make sure that what we have is useful, and then look at partners who can duplicate what we're doing, but we don't have to physically be there.
Evan pointed out, oh, look, here's a deer tick. And sure enough, so here's a deer tick live on public radio walking up my left leg. So, yeah, that's something we do have to talk to the students about, I guess. But again, probably deer ticks come out earlier in warmer years, right?
And
certainly deer ticks are moving northwards. Add it to the data. Yeah, there it goes. Actually, at Manomet, we saw the Lone Star tick, that cute little one with the silver in the middle, and that was the first I'd ever seen. So some things are moving northwards, not just birds.
How important is the hands-on support in terms of adopting something like this, as opposed to having to take the initiative? You could go find a curriculum or program that has instructions, but having to put it all into place yourself.
Well, it's absolutely wonderful as a teacher. We're pretty busy with our direct instruction in our classroom. So to have a curriculum where we can adapt it to our own particular classroom, to have the expertise of brilliant scientists is wonderful as a classroom teacher. And it just adds so much in terms of teaching.
And I think adapt to your local situation is just perfect, because these teachers here are the people who actually know the area and they know their students so well. So we can provide the basic science, but adapting it to the local area and making it really clear that science shows us that there is climate change, if you like, happening, and that we can measure it in our backyard, not just in the Arctic. Yeah.
So how did this particular partnership come about? I mean, was this a relationship between someone at Manomet and you as teachers, and you brought that to the school district, or did it start at the district level and kind of filter down to the teachers?
That'll be my doing. Yes. So I knew of Trevor's program, as I had said, and we actually had another school district that was interested in getting involved, which was Duxbury. And honestly, I can't remember. I think maybe Wildlands Trust had brought in that interest. I really honestly can't tell you. We're looking for funding. So this was great to get, again, a school district that I knew was interested in STEM inquiry-based learning. So it was just a great partnership. And so that is sort of my role, is trying to organize and try and get some funding to sustain this long-term.
I think when we started banding birds at Manomet in 1966 with Kathleen Anderson, our first director, and a bunch of volunteers, nobody was really thinking, okay, let's take some neat data that'll show climate change at the turn of the century. I mean, all we were doing was measuring birds and seeing when they came in and putting on U.S. Fish and Wildlife bands and taking basic data. And that data set turns out to be something that drove us to looking at it and saying, wow, these birds really are coming back earlier. The birds that winter in the southern part of the U.S. are returning a lot earlier in warmer years, not just in recent years. The birds in Central America seem to have an ability for at least half the species to pick up on that and arrive back earlier. The birds that winter in South America are not coming back, and there is no statistically significant difference. So then we had all of our neat bird data, which we published in fairly useless journals that nobody ever reads, down at the level of real kids and real people. And so the question was, how can we get that sort of information out? And that's really where those partnerships evolved. But I think it all started with the birds, and it started with all of us realizing that climate change is happening in our own backyards and not just in distant places.
Great.
Good enough.
Well, thank you guys. Yeah, that'll be great.
Thank you.
For
coming along with us.
Absolutely.
Let's message out to other people on the campus.
I spoke with migratory bird expert Trevor Lloyd Evans, as well as Manomet Center's Foundations Manager Beth Brazil, and two Forestdale School teachers, Peter Trimble and Renee Fudala. We're talking this hour about inquiry-based learning, particularly in the sciences. Before the break, we heard about a hands-on climate science project being piloted in Sandwich Public Schools. Joining me now to talk more about that project and other efforts to push inquiry-based learning are Gil Newton, director of Sandwich's STEM Academy, due to open its doors to all Sandwich 7th and 8th graders next September. And joining us by phone is Brian Drayton, co-director of the Center for School Reform at TURC, a Cambridge-based nonprofit organization that does curriculum development, particularly in the science and math areas. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Heather.
Thanks.
Now, Brian, I'd like to actually start with you. You were involved as kind of the curriculum development expert in the building of Climate Lab, this project that we were just hearing about, where students actually go out and measure plants to try to measure the impacts of climate change on a local level. How much consideration in building that project did you have to give to the new Common Core standards, or even, you know, previous standards for what middle school students need to be getting out of science class?
Well, you have to bear the standards in mind because since the late 90s, that's the way that, you know, the business of schooling has been framed. I should point out right now that in the Common Core refers to English and math, and the science and engineering standards are called next generation science standards. They're, of course, they're part of the same effort, but when you say Common Core, a teacher is likely to think math. For me as a developer and researcher, when I think about the standards, I'm thinking really from the point of view of the teacher more than the student. I think one of the teachers that you just had in that recording put it very well, which is that the goal for the students is to have a coherent, challenging, growthful experience of science, in this case, that really focuses on the process of finding a question that's really interesting and trying to learn something more about it in a systematic way that's informed by the practice of scientists. The teacher, on the other hand, has to think about when I lay out the lessons for this section of the year, am I including the right things that will help the students meet achievement goals that the district or the state has set for them? But the students, in a way, should not be thinking about the standards, and in a way, the teachers should feel free having understood the goals, to shape the experience for the students so that it's as deep and authentic as possible, trusting, as that teacher sort of implied, the really good instruction and really good experiences and materials will also equip the students to pass the exams they need to pass or whatever.
Now, Gil Newton, the students in Sandwich that are currently or going to be getting involved with the Climate Lab project this spring, they've got a little bit of a – there's going to be a little bit of a break. We were talking earlier about the fact that all of the 7th and 8th graders who are currently in – K through 8 schools and 3 different K through 8 schools in Sandwich next year are going to be moving to this one integrated STEM academy. And STEM usually stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. And that is the implication here. But apparently in the case of the Sandwich STEM Academy, you guys have a slightly different twist on what STEM means.
Yeah, we do. Basically, we're redefining STEM as strategies that engage minds. And I just want to reiterate some of the things that the teacher said, and that is getting the students involved directly with inquiry and project-based learning in their own backyards, looking at the kind of environment that surrounds them is a way of capturing their interests and their motivation. And in addition to that, I'm not worried about the standards because I think that the teachers will be able to incorporate almost all the standards from literacy to math to science to geography and all the other subjects we're doing based on that hands-on experience. And again, 7th and 8th graders is the perfect age, as Trevor was saying, for targeting that particular experience. This is a group of students that are very enthusiastic and highly motivated to do these sorts of projects. So I think that, yes, we're trying something a little different in Sandwich. We are focusing more on sciences and engineering, but we're also increasing access to other disciplines as well, including the arts and the humanities.
So how does that work? I mean, you're calling this a STEM academy. Does that literally mean that most of the classes that 7th and 8th graders will be taking in Sandwich starting next year will be math and science classes, or will they be going through the same suite of classes that all middle schoolers
have? They'll actually have the same set of classes that you would expect them to have. They'll have English, social studies, math, and science, but they're also going to have in their schedule other kinds of programs, including an engineering program in both 7th and 8th grade. They're going to have an opportunity to take some electives, including electives in English and social studies, as well as computer programming, archaeology, and science. They will also have an expanded health and wellness program, physical education, and they're even going to have an expanded art program. So the students really are going to have the same menu of opportunities in terms of curriculum, if not more so, than they get in other middle schools. The difference is that we have adopted inquiry and project-based learning across the board. And the ideal aspects of working with a partner like Manomet is that the teachers get to pilot some of these programs this year so they feel more comfortable in implementing that in their other courses as well.
So it's really more a matter of embracing the scientific method as a way of teaching and a way of learning more than just giving them more science classes.
That's right. And if you think about it, practically everything we do today follows the scientific method. We have to come up with some sort of a question. We design an experiment or some sort of a program to test that question. We then follow up with an analysis. And there's writing skills that are involved, mathematics skills, as well as whatever specific content might be determined by either the Common Core standards or the next generation of science standards.
I mean, there's obviously a big push to improve and enhance STEM education in this country. It's been one of President Obama's kind of talking points, signature efforts that we need to really beef up STEM education and STEM as part of our society and economy. But to take it to this level where you've got an entire STEM academy, 2 whole years, and really adopting this as a way of learning, I certainly haven't heard about anything like that locally. And Brian Drayton, I wonder if you could, chime in here. And how unusual is it to take the sort of STEM education to this extreme?
Well, I wouldn't say it's an extreme. There are STEM academies, so-called, springing up all around the country in lots of different settings. Every one of them is a sort of a fresh experiment, because the balancing of the different, you know, the emphasis on the different subject matters, the different emphases on that are required by the particular population of students you have, those balances have to be figured out freshly for every school and by every new set of teachers. It's also, I mean, people who don't do much with education sometimes think that project-based, or when they hear project-based or inquiry, they feel they feel like it's sort of an easy way out. They don't understand that to make sense of a complicated world with students who are just learning some of the basic mental skills for doing so requires extraordinary levels of understanding on the part of the teacher, not only the students, but of the content matter, in this case, the science itself. And every time you're working with a fresh person, a fresh set of people, with an exciting area that is probably changing, like the research on climate right now, where our understanding of the climate is actually driving fresh understandings in all the other sciences that relate to it. So the subject itself is shifting. Well, it's a field of inquiry, and the goal is to try to make sense of things, and the world is way smarter than we are. And so there are a lot of these STEM academies around, and to figure out how to bring a climate of inquiry, of rigorous inquiry, into a classroom at whatever age, from kindergarten, appropriate for its age, up to, you know, graduate school, has been a challenge, a persistent challenge in education in America and elsewhere for a century and a half. One of the exciting things about the Next Generation Science Standards, with which I have lots of quarrels, nevertheless, that they are putting inquiry front and center and showing how it really does provide, through its focus on the practices of science, a sort of a coherent way to approach any issue we have to bring our intelligence to.
Now, Gil Newton, you have in some of the materials explaining this new STEM Academy outlined what you call the 21st century life skills that students need. And that really goes to this whole issue of a complex world and inquiry. So what are those 21st century skills?
Well, first of all, we have no idea what the job market is going to be like for these students when they finally graduate from college 8-10 years from now. It would be presumptuous of us to try to even figure that out. Technology is changing so fast and opportunities are changing so fast that we really do not know, to be honest. However, we do know what kinds of skill sets students have to have. And 21st century skills that we're referring to are things such as collaboration. That's where the project-based learning comes into effect. And if I could just add a little bit about project-based learning, projects in the past have always been considered sort of an afterthought, something that you rewarded students for doing well, something that was like an enrichment activity. We're viewing project-based learning as the essential part of the curriculum, that all of their curricula are going to be taught using inquiry methods. Another important skill is for students to be able to communicate, and that's where the Common Core Standards are so essential, because the writing component in the Common Core Standards is pervasive across all disciplines, including the sciences. So we're expecting that our students will also be able to learn those important writing skills as well. And then, of course, there is communication. Communication is the use today of technology. All of our students will have some sort of one-to-one technology that will be available to them. Most likely the iPads, which is what we're using at the high school right now, but we're still discussing as to what that will look like. And then finally, there's creativity, that ability to innovate and to come up with new ideas and to work together to solve these various problems. So collectively, if you think about it, that really applies across the board. That's why we're looking for these kinds of interdisciplinary opportunities for students, such as what we're doing with Manomet and many others that are in the pipeline, so that the students will be able to exercise and learn all of these different skills.
That's Gil Newton, director of Sandwich's STEM Academy, due to open next September. Also with us is Brian Drayton, co-director of the Center for School Reform at Turk, and Gil Newton, director of Sandwich's STEM Academy, due to open its doors next September. Now, Gil Newton, before the break, you were mentioning this idea that the students, 7th and 8th graders, immersed in inquiry or project-based learning, and part of that is going to be this innate use of technology that is so intuitive and so much a part of children that age, their lives, they've always had this technology around. But they're going to, everybody's going to have, you were saying, a tablet possibly or some sort of computer technology available to them. How integral do you see that to this kind of learning, or is that just a part of life today?
Oh, I think it's a very important part of their learning, and certainly in Sandwich we have been emphasizing the use of this form of technology now for the last couple of years. And even on specific projects such as Manomet, you heard from Beth and Trevor that we are going to be working closely with students from Duxbury and Wareham, so it's an opportunity to share data that they've accumulated as well. We are going to put the students through a training period, of course, using iPads, most likely through one of our classes, such as the engineering program. But nevertheless, we expect that it'll be employed in all of the different classes.
So what is the technology being used for in those cases?
There's all kinds of research projects that the students use. Some of them use it for data collecting. Some of the students have used it in the past just for, like I said, basic research, for projects, for research papers. There are different apps that the students access for whatever the curriculum happens to be in that subject. So both teachers and students have gone or will be going through a training process so that they can maximize the use of them in the classroom. I mean, we're really thinking of switching more towards electronic sources of information as opposed to textbooks. The textbooks, particularly in the sciences, are out of date by the time they're published, and yet there's an enormous amount of information available to the students online and through access with their tablets. One of the things that we're doing also in our engineering program is that the teachers have been trained by a national organization called Project Lead the Way, which has their own curriculum available online. And again, the students will be using technology to access that and to carry out the various projects that are assigned to them. So I see this as becoming just part of their everyday life. And, you know, it probably already is for most of these students who already seem to be very skillful in using the different technologies.
So it's just making school more like real life again.
Yes, indeed.
Now, Brian Drayton, you have, I think, a slightly different take on the role of technology in inquiry-based education. I know your wife is a Waldorf school teacher, and of course, Waldorf is all about experiential learning, kind of this project or inquiry-based learning, but actually is completely against the use of technology, at least in the younger years of education. So I wonder where you see the fit for technology in inquiry-based learning.
So first I should say, at some point you should do a show sometime on Waldorf education, because there's a Waldorf school down in the Cape, and there's others near you, and I think your listeners would be really interested by it. Having said that, I am not a Waldorf educator, but I am a student both of learning and of educational history, and I am very careful about the thinking about the role of technology. It's an area of research in which you discover that every few years a new technology comes out that somebody thinks is going to be the silver bullet for whatever they think the current educational problem is. And I hear Gil not doing that, I should say. I'm not saying this in contradistinction to him. But there is a real challenge, as I have seen technology being used in the classroom, to let the technology assume more authority in the classroom than it really ought to. That is that, to put it really crudely, you can see classrooms in which if it can't be done through the computer, it doesn't get done. Mm. That's one of the values of having an actual science or other project to engage with, where what you're really trying to do is help the kids learn about the real world and using anything that will help you further that learning. That's where the teacher really has to bear the learning goals in mind. One of the great philosophers of science, Paul Feyerabend, once said that the only real scientific method is anything goes. And understanding that what you do is you use the tools that you have to hand as carefully and systematically as possible to answer the question you're after, that's the most important thing. So when they were out walking around on the field site with Trevor Lloyd Evans, one of the high-tech instruments that they were using was a measuring tape, and another high-tech instrument they were using was a toilet paper roll with a crosshair mounted at one end, which allows you to identify a specific point of observation.
Those are the ones we can afford.
And so the thing is that you use whatever technologies buy you what you need, so to speak, from the point of view of teaching and learning. So there are extraordinary resources available. We have seen, I'll stop in a second, but I will say that we've done some research projects in high school and middle school classrooms around the use of technology, and it can get in the way. So the value of a STEM academy approach, where everybody's trying to figure out what that can mean, what that can really bring to the students, the value is that the teachers, the faculty there, can really think these issues through and support each other to make sure that the learning objectives control how a technology is or is not used at a particular point.
Now, Gil Newton, in terms of the situation in Sandwich, what kind of resources go into creating a STEM academy like this? I mean, there's, for one, just the part of getting a tablet for every student obviously could be expensive. Mm-hmm. But I imagine that project-based learning can also place more resource demands on the school system than maybe traditional classroom styles.
Yeah, and if I could just follow up a little bit on what Brian just said, because I do agree with what he just said. One of the advantages that we're going to have in the STEM Academy is the way we have restructured how teachers work together. Right now, the teachers are housed in three different K-8 buildings, and there's very little communication between them with regards to curriculum. But when they are in the STEM Academy, they're going to be working in teams, two 7th grade teams and two 8th grade teams, all with the same common prep time of 80 minutes each day, which will give them all of the opportunities to have that kind of discussion of learning opportunities for kids that Brian was just referring to. To set up a new school like this, there is a certain amount of cost associated with it, needless to say. But Dr. Canfield, our superintendent, decided to go by moving the teachers and the students into the A wing of the high school, which saves millions of dollars in the construction of a new building. Mm-hmm. Consequently, we do have to add more resources in terms of equipment, particularly for our engineering program. We are rebuilding four science labs. We're adding two new art classrooms. So there's a certain amount of construction costs that are going to go initially into this. We are also adding some other programs, so there'll be some new teachers coming in, such as in health and wellness and art. But when you think about the direction that everyone's going in, and you alluded to that a few minutes ago, this is probably one of the more cost-effective ways of achieving this.
What about teacher training? I imagine right. There's some need to get them thinking in a very different way about how their classroom time is structured.
Yes, we have actually begun teacher training last spring, where we had a number of workshops on what is inquiry and how do we apply it to our classroom. And then this summer, we offered a course in project-based learning, which was sponsored by the Buck Institute for Education. They came in for 3 days, and I did two follow-up days with the teachers on differentiation and assessment. We're using all of our in-service time and curricula time this year to focus on getting us ready for the STEM Academy. And part of the evidence that this is working was just last Thursday evening when 18 teachers, 7th and 8th grade teachers in the town of Sandwich, presented their ideas on their projects, what they're doing and what they're planning on doing with the students at a parents' forum. So we are in the process of working with the teachers to make sure that they are ready and understand what we mean by PBL and inquiry-based learning.
So how have parents and families in the Sandwich School District responded to this?
We've had enormous support from parents and from students. I've spent a lot of time working with a parent STEM task force that have been absolutely phenomenal in their support and help for those of us putting this together. They have sponsored meet and greet nights. They sponsor the parent forums. They're working with me to organize a number of activities so that the kids get to know each other, because just as the teachers are in three separate buildings, so are the students. So it's going to be a big change for students in the town of Sandwich who are used to their K-8 buildings to come now into the high school and create a whole new situation for them. So I've been meeting with the kids. They're in the process of putting together their design, their own mascot for the STEM Academy. They're going to have a different athletics program where they're going to actually be able to play teams from other school districts, where right now they just play each other. So there's going to be a lot of changes for them too. But the parents group has been absolutely wonderful.
Now, Brian Drayton, as you've already alluded to, it's not like inquiry-based learning is a new idea that popped up last year. People have been working on incorporating inquiry into education for over a century. Is there a particular stumbling block that has kept us from embracing inquiry-based learning in our schools?
Well, it's hard to pick just one. If I had to summarize it simply, I would say it's hard to do. The teachers need to really understand their material. They need to listen closely to the students and hold them to pretty high standards, by which I don't mean anything that can be measured on an exam necessarily, but to really push them to articulate more fully, to convey their ideas in through different methods, both visually and in writing and in words. To understand what makes, what's good logic and what's not, what's good evidence and what's not, where the sources of error are, to learn from mistakes. That takes that's very challenging for a teacher to supervise, encourage, and often guide, in a thoughtful manner.
So would you say, I mean, do we have a history of kind of failed experiments of trying to incorporate inquiry and it doesn't really work because it's too hard?
Well, yes. And I would say there's sort of a pendulum that swings back and forth. Massachusetts, for example, was part of the statewide systemic initiative in the 1990s, emphasized, Gil probably was part of that.
Called POMS.
Yes.
Yeah. I remember it well.
Yes. The science teachers with whom Turk worked were really, excited about the idea of inquiry. They were supported by the school districts and the regional educational organizations around the state. But when the standards came in and the MCAS came in, many people felt like they couldn't take the risk that they might not be hitting one or another of the standards. It's taken a long time for people to realize that really good education means that you'll hit the levels of education achievement you need, and you can't always be second guessing yourself. You have to keep your eye on the prize, so to speak. And I wanted to say one other thing, which is that one of the most important findings of educational research in the past half century is that in-service teacher learning and making real space for that is the single most important contributor to putting this in place. And by that, I don't necessarily mean just courses or workshops and so forth, but allowing the teachers time to work together to figure out what just happened, how could I do this better, what's it going to take to do this next thing that we're working on, and to structure those meetings so they're really focused and systematic. You know, the countries that we sometimes look to, like Finland or Japan or Germany or Hong Kong, where the student achievement seems to be higher in many ways, another thing we could have another conversation about, in those countries, teacher preparation is up to half the time the teacher spends in their workday.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there, but obviously the importance of teacher preparation and training emphasized. Brian Drayton is co-director of Center for School Reform at Turk, a Cambridge-based nonprofit curriculum development organization. Gil Newton is director of Sandwich's STEM Academy, due to open its doors to all Sandwich 7th and 8th graders next September. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. So long, Gil.
This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.